Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're continuing our week of honoring Martin Luther King Jr., the conversations on King's legacy on nonviolent resistance. We speak with Omar Barghouti, a founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. With Willa Bickham, who's a peace activist and co-founder of Viva House, a Catholic worker house in a soup kitchen in southwest Baltimore. And Mark Kurlansky, journalist, historian, and author of Nonviolence, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But first, we'll hear from Dr. King himself in this 1957 interview with Martin Agronsky. He discusses his philosophy of nonviolence in great depth. This occurred right after President Dwight D. Eisenhower sent the National Guard to protect the students at Little Rock High School when they first integrated that school.
Gandhi, Dr. King, dramatized and defined the technique of nonviolence, and yet he also said that the only alternative to fear is violence, and that if that were the alternative, he would have to choose violence. Do you subscribe to that judgment of Gandhi, or would you disavow violence under any conditions?
Well, I think I would have to somewhat interpret Gandhi at this point. I don't think he was setting forth violence as an alternative. I think he was emphasizing or rather trying to refute an all too prevalent fallacy, and that is that the persons who use the method of nonviolence are actually the weak persons, persons who don't have the weapons of violence, persons who are afraid. But I think that is what Gandhi was attempting to refute. Now, in that instance, I would agree with Gandhi that if the only alternative to violence, is violence and vice versa, then I would say fight. But it isn't the only alternative. And that is the one point that Gandhi was trying to bring out. It seems to me that there are three ways that oppressed people can deal with their oppression.
What are they, Dr. King?
Well, one is to rise up in open violence, in physical violence. And some persons have used that method, persons who have been oppressed. But I think the danger of that method is its futility. I feel that violence creates many more social problems than it solves.
May I interrupt you there, Dr. King? There are today certainly people who are forced to endure a kind of injustice that neither you nor even Gandhi in his time had ever seen. For example, would you regard the martyrs of Hungary's rebellion a year ago as misguided men and having used violence?
I admire freedom fighters wherever they are, but I still believe that nonviolence is the strongest approach. I think that would apply to the Hungarian situation also. I don't think it's limited to a particular locality. I think it should apply in every situation in the world where individuals seek to break loose from the bondage of colonialism or from some totalitarian regime or from the system which we confront in America.
You truly believe then that nonviolence is the sole, the universal answer to injustice and oppression?
Very definitely. Very definitely. I feel that nonviolence, organized nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
You make a difference, a distinction between passive resistance and nonviolent resistance, is that it?
Well, I think that can be something of a semantical problem. If passive resistance means just passively accepting violence or injustice, if it means cowardice and stagnant passivity, then there is a difference, because nonviolent resistance does resist. It is dynamically active. It is passive physically, but it is strongly active spiritually.
In a sense, would you regard it as moving into the Christian philosophy too? You mean the doctrine of turn the other cheek to regard as positive rather than passive?
I think it is positive. I think very definitely, if it is used properly and accepted with the proper attitude, it is a very strong method. It is a method of the strong man, not the weak man.
That was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking with Martin Nagronsky in 1957. There was a man I interviewed who's been on the show several times who wrote a book on nonviolence we'll talk about. He's written books that many of you remember, like Salt, Cod, and wrote a book on 1968. This book that he wrote that we talked about when he first came out in 2006 was Nonviolence, the History of a Dangerous Idea. And Mark Kalansky is with us right now. Mark, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be talking to you, Mark.
Mark, we were talking before we went on the air about the 1960s and about how the movement really got divided over issues of violence, about violent overthrow of government and nonviolent resistance and nonviolent pushes. And one of the things you said rather eloquently at that moment was how during that period when you were around, you just could not get with the violence. You said that never really appealed to you.
Yeah, it just it always seemed like a mistake. Just in purely practical terms, this is what the Quakers love about me. I don't argue spiritual, religious things on this. Just let's just be pragmatic. You know, if you threaten people, they don't act well. It's that simple, and you're not going to bring people to your cause by intimidating them. History shows this over and over again, but there's something counterintuitive about it that makes people resist it. And, you know, I don't think it's very well remembered these days that the idea of nonviolence in the black struggle of the 1960s was very controversial between blacks. Many blacks opposed it, didn't think it would work. And actually, initially, Martin Luther King opposed it when he was a college student.
Uh-huh.
Spoke out against it was persuaded otherwise largely by Bayard Rustin, one of the earliest civil rights workers, who was a Quaker, and by a movement, a nascent movement that was influenced by a guy named Richard Gregg, who had been to India and studied under Gandhi. Rustin went down to Atlanta to talk to King and said his house was full of guns. He almost sat on a gun on the couch by accident. convinced him, and King remained convinced, that this was the only thing that was going to work. You weren't going to have a black uprising that was going to end racism in the United States. You had to find another way of doing it. And while it was happening, it wasn't apparent to everybody that this was a working idea. I mean, in 1964, 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, which the Supreme Court supposedly desegregated public schools, 1% of black public school students in the South were in integrated classrooms. A minuscule percentage of Southern blacks were able to vote in 64 and in 68. We tend to remember the civil rights movement as this sweeping triumph, but it wasn't. It was a long, hard struggle. I believe that the nonviolent tactic of it gave it a resonance that made it endure and eventually triumph. Movements that came out in the late 60s that opposed nonviolence, stemming from Malcolm X, Black Nationalists, and Black Panthers, and I think they made some very good arguments, but I think the image that they put forth was destructive to getting this country to realize its moral responsibility. There was a great phrase of James Baldwin in the early 60s. He described the civil rights movement as a movement that was taking on a dangerously adolescent country.
Mm-hmm. And that's true, I think. I mean, that's really, in many ways, we still are. But when you wrote the book on nonviolence, and you came up with so many stories in different parts of our human history where the resistance to oppression was led by nonviolence in very successful ways, because we only think of Gandhi, we only think of King.
Yeah,
we only think
when,
of the
when movie, I when it, I came out with the book and I told people about the book, they would say, "So this is a book about Gandhi and King."
Right.
Many other people and many movements since.
So talk a bit about some of the ones that really affected you the most when you wrote that book. What were some of the ones that stand out, you think, are things that people need to wrestle with that they would never think about?
I think it is very telling. I think there is a great lesson. Another thing people all said to me when the book came out is, and Nelson Mandela.
Right.
Well, Nelson Mandela was not nonviolent.
Correct.
He was actually the person who took the movement to violence. And while he was in prison, Desmond Tutu and some other people, after many years of nonviolence not working, started thinking about other tactics of economic boycott and nonviolent resistance. And that's what overthrew apartheid after violence had failed for decades. One of the real misconceptions in all of this is the idea people say, well, you know, nonviolence is fine, you know, if you're posing somebody nice. You know, they make the argument, the British always make this argument that, you know, it was easy for Gandhi because he was just opposing the British, which are really nice, fine people. Well, these nice, fine people were mowing down crowds with women and children with machine guns. I mean, British colonialism was pretty tough. But in any event, it's really almost the opposite, that if your opponents are really ruthless and brutal, you're not going to beat them at their own game. You throw their game off by doing something else. Nonviolence did, on a number of occasions, work against the Nazis. It worked against the Soviet Union. If you just compare the resistance in Central Europe to the Soviet Union later on to the Hungarian uprising, which was an armed uprising, you know, you see that an armed uprising was easy for them because they got better arms.
Right. You know, when you wrote about, you wrote about so many stories. There was a story that, and I'm blocking now on the name of the leader of this movement and how this movement started. But it took place in New Zealand with the Maoris.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's an incredible story because there had been a violent, the Maori had, who were the indigenous people who had been, you know, oppressed by the British who took over and had violently resisted them for years and years and gotten nowhere. And then this movement arose that used nonviolent tactics, and they just didn't know what to do with it. By the way, this was also true of the American Revolution before it became the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't think in those terms, but, you know, all of those actions that were done before Concord and Lexington were nonviolent. The Boston Tea Party and all kinds of boycotts of British goods and don't buy Manchester cloth, John Adams. And, And they had him. They completely had the British. And, you know, towards the end of his life, John Adams said so, that, you know, we just had them defeated before 1775. And so there's this very interesting question of why did it end up in a violent war? Well, a lot of people opposed the violent war for that reason, and the Continental Congress had many people arguing against it and arguing against the Declaration of Independence because it was worded in a way that was guaranteed to lead to a shooting war, which there had already been some shooting incidences. And, you know, people argued, we don't need this violence. We've won. Let's not do this. But the prevailing view was to have the war. And, you know, I think the reason why, I don't get a lot of help from historians on this. Nobody seems to want to talk about this. But it seems that the reason why was that it was the best way for the group who called themselves the Patriots, you know, Adams and Jefferson and all those people, to really coalesce a power center, to you know, war as a way of nation building.
Well, I wonder what those lessons that you learned from history, from this book, say to us about today. We talked a bit earlier, before we got together on this, officially on the phone, about Palestinian Israelis, about what the power that could do if it was a nonviolent movement. But what does it say? Two things. A, what does it say to us today about the power of nonviolence in the world today? And B, why do you think it's so hard to get to?
Well, if you look at the Arab Spring, it started as a nonviolent movement in Tunisia and Egypt, and didn't stay that way in Syria, which is still going on, and other places. You know, these countries like Libya, you know, are just a mess, and you know, God knows what it's going to take to rebuild them, because of the violent way that they were overthrown.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, Egypt is not a peaceful democracy at the moment, but you know, certainly anybody would take the Egyptian situation over the Libyan situation or the Syrian situation. You know, and you see this over and over again. One of the problems with violence is that it doesn't end. It creates an aftermath. I mean, the Civil War, you know, created the kind of reconstruction that, you know, people forget how the 1963 March on Washington came about, as King went around that year doing a number of speeches, the centerpiece of which was, this is the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and 100 years later, we still aren't free. And it was absolutely true. Blacks didn't have the vote. They didn't have access to decent schools. They didn't have any economic opportunities. They were impoverished. They were virtually in slavery in Mississippi. And so the Civil War was not a success. Of course, the Civil War also wasn't fought to free the slaves, so that's another thing. But, you know, you see over and over again that if you have a good cause, that violence is not the best way to get there, because it creates a situation that becomes very, very difficult. I watched Burma, Myanmar, with a lot of interest, and long standing nonviolent movement, and like the civil rights movement, it reached this point where a lot of people were saying, you know, violence just doesn't work, and nonviolence just doesn't work, and we're going to have to get armed and do something. But enough people opposed that and stayed with the nonviolence, and it has worked. And that country is slowly progressing.
So, as someone who deeply believes in this and has written about it, and you've even though you wrote the book a bunch of years back, 7 years ago, it's still something that is inside of you. It's who you are. Do you hold out? Do you think about that? Do you believe that we, as human beings in the societies we live in, who want deep social change, and see this divide in the world, that nonviolence can actually take hold and be one of the catalysts for real change?
Yes, I do. I'm hopeful that more people will see that. Because war has not worked very well for people. One of the big problems is government. people get into government and they have all these weapons, and it's their power. And they, when you think about it, government are the only people who are sanctioned to kill people. It's done by the government. It's supposedly not murder. And it's much harder to get people in government to reject that option than it is the public. But wars have become increasingly unpopular. Hillary Clinton supported the Iraq war, I think because she thought it was a savvy political move, and it would have been a bad political move to have opposed it. And she was exactly wrong. It cost her the presidency. People aren't in love with war anymore. They never were, but they're growing more outspoken about it.
Mark Kalansky, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Mark Kalansky is the book we're talking about. He wrote 7 years ago, Nonviolence, The History of a Dangerous Idea. He's also wrote 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, Cod and Salt, which put him on the map. And his new book is going to be ready for a brand new beat. It's coming out in July, and we're looking forward to that book, Dancing in the Streets and Its Deep Social Significance. And Mark, thank you once again for joining us.
Great talking to you, Mark.
And now we turn to the activist committed to nonviolent resistance today. We're about to talk with Omar Barghouti, who is a founding committee member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. And Omar Barghouti, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. One of the things that people wrestle with here when they watch the struggle of Palestinians to end the occupation of the West Bank is the... what people see as violence, not just from the occupation army and the Israeli police and the Israelis, but the violence from the Palestinians fighting for the end of the occupation. And there always seems to be this struggle inside the Palestinian community, as are many communities, around the issue of how to fight for liberation. And I'm curious what role you think the nonviolent movements play in that.
Okay, first, it's important to see the context of this nonviolent movement. And the context is not just the occupation of the West Bank, in fact. Israel has a three-tiered system of oppression against the Palestinian people. The most important form of oppression is actually not the occupation. It's the denial of the right of return for refugees. And I say that's the key question of, that's the core of the question of Palestine, simply because 69% of Palestinians are refugees. Whether those living inside Israel, in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, including Jerusalem, or in the diaspora in exile, the great majority of Palestinians are refugees. According to 2012 statistics, only 38% of the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza, and even 40% of those or more are refugees. So the issue to the Palestinians is ending the exile of the refugees, allowing them to go home, as all refugees around the world, as well as ending the occupation. And the third issue we're working to achieve is ending Israel's special system of racial discrimination, which meets the UN definition of the crime of apartheid. So in this context, it's very important to understand what thinkers like Frantz Fanon once said, that all violence starts with the oppressor. And the oppressed, the violence of the oppressed is a reaction to the violence of the oppressor. So if we are truly interested in ending all violence, and I hope we are, then we should address the root causes of violence, and that's colonial oppression and apartheid. Without addressing those, we can never end the cycle of colonial violence. Given that, the Palestinian popular resistance movement is a very important component of Palestinian resistance today, and BDS is one form of Palestinian popular nonviolent resistance. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel is a key form of that. And yes, there is debate all the time among Palestinians about the tactics. What are the best forms of resistance? We in the BDS movement have always said BDS is not an alternative. It's not instead of any other form of resistance, like resistance against the wall and against the colonies and demonstrations and strikes and so on and so forth. It's one main form of resistance that's morally consistent, that's completely anchored in international law and human rights principles, and that rejects all forms of racism, including Islamophobia and including anti-Semitism. So that's where we stand in our nonviolent movement, in the BDS movement.
That was Omar Barghouti, founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear more from Omar Barghouti and speak with Willa Bickham, a local peace activist and co-founder of the Viva House, a Catholic worker house and soup kitchen in Southwest Baltimore. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and today we're discussing Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy. Specifically, during this hour, his philosophy of nonviolent resistance. We're speaking with activists who are committed to nonviolent resistance for social change. So let's get right back to our conversation with Omar Barghouti, who's the founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. So when you look at the struggle that's taking place, just for the moment, focusing on the West Bank and Gaza, and then we can come back to the larger struggle. I mean, we've done interviews with people in Budrus and other places that have literally nonviolently confronted Israeli troops with allies and stopping Israelis from at least tearing down their olive groves or building part of the wall or whatever the struggle is at the moment, a specific struggle. I mean, how does that fit into the context, though, of the larger Palestinian struggle? I mean, do you believe that those kind of things are, those kind of nonviolent direct actions are models for how to win the struggle? Or do you think they are just a part of the struggle and they're not always useful or viable?
They're always part of the struggle. They're not the struggle. The point is, Israel's system of oppression against the Palestinians is globalized. The U.S. is a major part of it. So when we talk about the Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, denial of refugee rights, we're talking made in the USA. It has made in the USA all over it. Without U.S. taxpayers' subsidy to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, without U.S. support for Israel diplomatically, politically, financially, and so on, Israel cannot sustain its system of oppression. So whether it's in Budrus, Belayin, Na'alin, Nabi Saleh, or any other village that's fighting against Israel's illegal wall built on occupied territory, that must be part of a global struggle to counter Israel's globalized oppression, multi-tiered oppression against the Palestinians. In other words, we cannot do it alone. So long as taxpayers in the U.S. are subsidizing the Israeli occupation and covering up Israel's crimes against the Palestinians, we cannot, by ourselves, our resistance, no matter how sophisticated, how it gets, it cannot alone do the job of ending the oppression and ending the occupation and apartheid. We absolutely need international solidarity. And this is a key lesson we learned from the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Although we're inspired very much by the civil rights movement in the U.S. by Martin Luther King, but that was a very local struggle whose global element was much less South African case, the struggle was internal and external in parallel. The international solidarity in terms of boycott, divestment, and sanctions was a key pillar of the four pillars of struggle in South Africa. This is the same in the Palestinian question. Without effective boycotts and sanctions from the outside, which are also nonviolent forms of solidarity, our popular struggle cannot win alone.
So, I mean, so two things come to mind as you were speaking, Omar Barghouti. I mean, the internationalization of the struggle, as you describe it, you see as part of the nonviolent resistance. So, what has been the effect of that struggle, do you think, from your perspective at this moment?
Okay, well, I'll just talk about the BDS movement, which is my area of expertise, as I'm one of the founding members of that movement. In the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which was launched in 2005, that's 7.5 years ago. That's not a long enough time. But despite the short period, we've entered the mainstream in the West. We've gained support from major trade union federations across the world in the global South. Several Jewish groups have started endorsing BDS campaigns. Feminist groups, anti-war movements, LGBT groups, so on and so forth. Major musicians have refrained from playing Israel. So we've really entered a level where I've always spoken about our South Africa moment has arrived. Indeed, it has. And we're seeing the effect on Israel's collective psyche, the establishment panic at the growth of BDS, at the growth of Israel's isolation. Increasingly, this is being discussed. Even Obama recently, it was revealed, is saying that Israel is increasingly isolated in the world and its policies will lead to further isolation. Yes, Netanyahu takes some credit for this isolation, but the other part of the credit goes to the millions of activists around the world who have supported Palestinian rights in so many creative ways and helped our popular struggle against Israel.
So, somebody said this on the show recently when we talked in this program today that they thought that as an activist, they thought that if Palestinians and the minority of Israelis who are their allies in ending the occupation and for freedom for Palestinians engaged in a nationwide, massive, nonviolent resistance on the ground locally, that it could end the stranglehold of occupation almost overnight because it would be difficult to have a response to it. What do you think about that?
A bit far-fetched, I would say, given that the number. it's very romantic. It looks at the occupation from a very romantic perspective. The occupation is not a few soldiers sitting here or there. If overwhelmed by nonviolent demonstrations, they'll just run away. Palestinians have been doing nonviolent resistance for decades. It's not something that we learned from Gandhi, Martin Luther King, or any other person. We're inspired by all those leaders, but we've had nonviolent popular resistance in our heritage for decades. From the onslaught of settler colonialism in our land, we've used nonviolent resistance tactics. So really, it's not that we need advice or how to be creative. We need actual, effective, concrete support. And more than anything else, we need people to help end complicity. In other words, going back to Martin Luther King, in a few days we celebrate his birthday, he referred to boycott as withdrawing support for an evil policy or system. In other words, Martin Luther King is saying that this is not heroic. But when people ask you to boycott a complicit company, a complicit institution, to divest from Caterpillar, let's say, or some other corporation that's complicit in human rights violations, it's not heroic. We're not asking you to leave everything aside in your life and just jump to the garrisons to help defend the Palestinians. We're asking you to help end the complicity of institutions that you have some influence in.
Omar Barghouti, it's an honor to talk to you, and I think that you've laid out the principles very clearly for our listeners. Omar Barghouti is founding committee member of the Palestinian Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights, who joins us as we talk this hour with nonviolent activists from around the country and around the world. Omar Barghouti, stay safe, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
And we are joined here by Willa Bickham, who is one of the founders and leaders of Viva House, a member of the Catholic Workers Movement. It's always a pleasure to see her. We got her in the studio here. Willa, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Willa, take us, first of all, before we talk about you and nonviolence and the world you come from, part of the world you come from is the Catholic worker world.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Talk to our listeners about what the Catholic worker world is.
Well, the Catholic Worker is a movement started in New York City by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin in 1933. So this year will be our 80th anniversary.
Wow, so many anniversaries. All these threes happening.
I know. I know. And in the house at Viva House, we have main poster is Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Dorothy Day, because those would be, for us, the Bible of our nonviolence. They would be the leaders and the movers for our movement. We kind of are old timers. We've been at this about 45 years. So some of our roots go back pretty far with Dorothy when she was still living.
So what was this Catholic Workers Movement that she started?
It's a movement to do the works of mercy, that is, clothe the naked, feed the poor, feed the hungry, bury the dead, the works of mercy from the Gospels, and then to resist the works of war, that which makes people poor. So we would try to spend as much time resisting as we would doing hospitality like soup kitchen and food pantry, things like that. There's about 200 houses like ours throughout the country and some of the states, some of Europe. But each one does something a little different, perhaps. There's different ways. And it's very interesting. We're about the last of the big soup kitchen people. The young folks don't want to do this at all. Atlanta, New York, Los Angeles, and us. We're outmoded. The young ones, Dorothy never thought the movement was for married people, single people. Unless you were single, celibate, or whatever, how could you be dedicated to nonviolence and resistance, you know? But we've changed that over the years, and now all the new Catholic workers are families. And what they do is they would have space in their house to take, like, one or two families, and they spend a lot of time doing resistance. So I think Dorothy'd be thrilled. She died in 1980.
Right. So the movement, the Catholic Workers Movement is not centralized, but connected.
Connected. There's no boss. We don't have to check with anybody. If you want to start a Catholic worker house, you just start the house. When we started, Dorothy was still living, so of course she gave us some monies to start up and to mailing list for Maryland to get a base. So that's how we've developed over the years, and absolutely dedicated to nonviolence. We've certainly understood the struggles of Northern Ireland and Nicaragua, El Salvador, South Africa, where nonviolence wasn't always an option. They had to do some self-defense, perhaps. But we try our best to be pacifists.
So I wonder a couple of things here. You came out of the church. You were a nun for a long time.
Right.
Brendan Walsh, your husband.
Mm-hmm.
Was a novitiate. They never officially became a priest, right?
Seminary, yeah, about
seminary.
A year away. Yes.
A year away. Uh-huh. So I'm curious. I mean, a couple of things. What is it about the Catholic Church and people come out of the Catholic Church? Whether it was the Plowshares movement and the Berrigans and all the people around them and Liz McAllister and that crew of people, many of whom spent a lot of time in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting the war and fighting nuclear weapons and like in your world. What is it about, you think, that what is it out of the Catholic world that breeds this movement, that breathes this movement as well as breeds it?
I think it's the social justice aspect of the Catholic Church, which nowadays I don't think folks know much about. But if you think about it, we grew up with the older Catholic Church where we were coming out of the Vatican II Council, which was very, very liberating. And that's the point at which a lot of nuns left. That's right when I was leaving the convent. And I had a very good mother.
Leaving the convent to leave?
To no longer be a nun.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah,
yes. Right.
Because I was in an old community where, you know, we wore the full habits and all that kind of stuff. But this Mother Superior, she wanted to make sure I knew what I was doing. And so she sent me, we were a teaching order. I was going to be a nurse in the community, but teaching order. But she sent me to Anguilla, Mississippi in the summer of 1962 to work at a mission with two other sisters. And that was life-changing for me. She was, thank God she did that, because I got in trouble with the local parish because we were teaching First Communion to the white kids. And I thought we could just relate to everybody. Aren't we all God's children, you know? Well, I was told you won't be effective. You can't talk to both races. So I had never known that. I grew up in an Irish ghetto. I mean, this is the south side of Chicago, and I didn't know anything. But I figured out that we must all be equal. And so that was just the beginning of Freedom Summer, and my eyes just, you know, came open. And then a couple years later, not that I knew much of anything. I tried real hard to learn more about racism. But I marched with Dr. Martin Luther King in Cicero, and that was rough. I didn't tell my parents, didn't tell my family, because they would just die if they ever heard I was with all those people. So it's just a little peon in this march. But boy, did I learn a lot.
So that's what began your sojourn, was this being placed by your order in Mississippi?
Yes.
That's what began it all.
Yes. I really didn't know much about anything, you know. And so that was very important in my life.
So, but then obviously clearly something also happened, which you really embraced this in a much deeper way. It became not just something that opened your eyes and shocked you and made you understand that human rights and civil rights was something to fight for all humanity and social justice, but something happened.
Something
pushed you into this world.
Yes. I knew that I didn't want to obviously be a nun anymore, but I wanted to be part of a lay community. I wanted to be part of a community that lived with poor people. For some, that was doing missionary work within the church confines. That was something. But I didn't want to do that. We really didn't have a whole lot of options in those early 60s. The Peace Corps was just started. But in my world, you get married after high school. I mean, that's just the way of it. And you didn't live in your own apartment. You went from your father's home to your husband's home. So to live in a group with a lay community like I did, I chose to come here to Baltimore to live with Joseph House Group. My parents didn't like that at all. Oh, no. You know, funny things can happen. And then to move into, from there, Brendan and I moved. Brendan was working in Baltimore in St. Peter Claver neighborhood with Phil Berrigan. And we chose to move to the D.C. Catholic Worker after a while. And real mixed community in the height of all the Pentagon, Vietnam War activities, and it was, we were hurled right into it with the Vietnam War.
So talk a bit to us about, again, the nonviolence and how you define nonviolence in terms of how you live life. I mean, I think that's, talk about it in a moment maybe as a social political tactic and strategy, but what about what does it mean for living a life?
Well, we try very hard to live simply. It certainly is a way of life to study Gandhi and learn the teachings of Martin Luther King. We certainly have the experience of living with Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker. And from that, you try. Voluntary poverty is part of the Catholic Worker. And so we try not to own anything. Try to be free of some of the more worldly things, and yet we're part of the whole world, you know. And to live among the poor so that you don't forget, you know. As our friend in Belfast, Des Wilson, says, you just want to have that edge about you. You have to know what you're living for, and you know what you're willing to die for.
And you and where you live in Viva House is the place you live in, and
where
you work.
West Baltimore.
West Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. And the wire
territory.
That's our neighborhood.
And you were in the wire.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But the I remember when I visited you last and we did a taping at your house with
yes.
you and Brendan.
Yes.
That you live simply, but you live well.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's because we live in this world where everything is material good. That's what makes people seem satisfied. But you live well in a very different way.
We sure do. Yes. We lack for nothing. It's a very... It's a very interesting way of living.
You raise yes. and raise a child there.
Just one. Yep. Beautiful young daughter.
So people thought you were crazy. You're living in this very poor neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You could be anywhere else if you wanted to be, mm-hmm. but that's where you chose to live and do work among the poor, feeding the poor mm-hmm. at Viva House.
Mm-hmm. I have to say though, over the years, my parents and Brendan's parents, they became more resigned, perhaps, and nowadays we have our grandchildren and the nieces and nephews from Chicago and New York, they come and work at the soup kitchen sometime. They're proud of it. I think it's more acceptable now.
So when people say there's power in nonviolence, I'm just curious about how, for our listeners, how the world you live, whether it's the resistance, the demonstrations, talk a bit about nonviolence and the power of that and why you think that's such a huge thing that we lose. Because we're in a world now where we're debating whether or not we should have gun control, whether or not we should have a right to have Bushmaster rifles with 24-round clips that can pop off in just a minute, all those bullets. And that's the battle we're having. We're not talking about the issue of nonviolence and how we treat one another as human beings. We're talking about whether or not we should be able to have the most powerful weapon on the planet.
And this very afternoon, our grandchildren in public school are doing a lockdown practice, which will go on in the public schools every month. It just, I can't, I just would cry. They and have armed police. It's, this is really sad.
So, but in terms of the nonviolence you believe in as a way of life, what is the power of nonviolence to you?
Ah, well, there's a good example of that. We just read in the paper yesterday, more news today, about the juvenile jail that's not going to be built.
Right.
And that is because of the power of the students of this city. The Algebra Project, the city school students, and a lot of
leaders of beautiful struggle, those
yes,
young people.
Yes, over and right. over in the mud, that vacant lot, and marching down to City Hall. And they got it changed. That's the power of nonviolence. That jail will no longer be built. We're not going to house these kids, warehouse these kids. We're going to try to actually help them that are arrested.
So nonviolence has a place.
Oh, it does.
What is its place for you? What's that message for you, for all of us? Before we went on the air, you talked about, Liz McAllister.
Right.
Former nun.
Right.
Who was married to Phil Berrigan.
Exactly, yes.
Spent time in prison.
A lot of time in prison, yes. And they have always, always worked with us through all our demonstrations and direct action. We've been to City Hall so many times with groups of people. The governor, when he was mayor, decided we could no longer feed people in front of City Hall, the plaza in front of City Hall.
Yes, right.
So, of course, what we did was on Martin Luther King Day that year, we got all the food together we could, happy birthday cakes from Martin Luther King, and served hundreds of people in City Hall. And no longer did that become an ordinance. The same thing with Mimi DiPietro when he decided that...
Former city councilman.
Yes, right. Yes. He decided that we were going to arrest the people who were sleeping on benches or on streets. And so what we did for a few days is have a sleep-in in front of City Hall. And went into city council and carried on, and that was no longer a problem. You could not arrest people for sleeping on the street. And the irony is that we know from our history that you and I can park our car on the street. We can have 8 feet or so, and a person can't have a few feet to rest their head. I mean, so we had a lot of fun like that. Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, and again, I was thinking about you, and I was thinking about Father Dick Lawrence and other people in this movement, that it gets lost in the kind of the both the power of the hierarchy of the church. It gets lost in what we think is important and who we give voice to,
mm-hmm.
And that's part of the, I think maybe there's a consistency in your values about that.
Well, action's important. I mean, we can all stand up and speak our minds about nonviolence or read as much as we can about nonviolence, but at some point you have to get out there and do something. You have to be part of some vigil or fast or protest or on Monday there'll be at the inauguration a die-in to protest the use of drones by this president.
And you'll be there, and you.
I hope so.
When we broadcast this, you'll have already done it, but you will be there. And it's that whole world that you're describing. I think that it's I'm curious about how your work at Viva House, how you're living in Southwest Baltimore among the poor, feeding people, counseling people, working with people. What's it done to the two of you? How has it changed you? How does it change the woman in 1968 who walked into Viva House to the woman you are now in 2013? You're still at Viva House in Southwest Baltimore.
I am, and I'm still filled with energy, but we certainly have let the younger people, not let, we are proud of the younger people who take over and plan all this, and we continue to do the death penalty vigil on Mondays when we can. But everybody, there's a constant death penalty vigil on Mondays in front of the city jail.
That you're part of.
That we're part of, and that's since Thanos was arrested. So how many, that's a long time we've been doing. I think that was 92, that Thanos was executed, excuse me.
This could be your last year.
I know. I think it's going to happen. I really think it's going to happen, yes.
The death penalty be no more.
I know. And there's so many states, like we have visitors, like students come from like Michigan, and they, what do you mean go down to the death penalty vigil? I mean, they don't have it. They don't even deal with that anymore. So we're praying that it's abolished this year.
It could very well happen.
Mm-hmm.
You won't have to do that anymore during the week.
I know. Got a free Monday.
Well, Bickham, I just, you and Brendan Walsh, two of my favorite people on the planet Earth.
Oh, man. Pay you to say that?
No. You really are.
Thank you.
Viva House is a very important institution, and your consistency and love and passion for humanity is important, and I'm glad you share that with us today.
Thank you for putting the show on.
Thank you.
Bye now.
On our way out of here, let's listen to The Ravens Express, the new song written by Renaud, and performed by Renaud and the E.A. Poe Boys Band. Renaud grew up in Baltimore. His band, Renaud and the Junction, opened for all the great Motown acts and was a recording sensation of his own. He wrote this years back for the Baltimore Colts and has reworked it for the Ravens. So I bring you the soul star, horse whisperer, and dear friend Renaud, and the Ravens Express. Go Ravens! The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. And knows the direction of the end zone.